The Psychoanalysis Podcast explores the ways that horror movies examine mental health issues. It deals with mature and sometimes disturbing subject matter, and it may not be suitable for all listeners. It is meant for entertainment purposes only, and not as a substitute for proper therapy. If you or a loved one are currently experiencing mental health difficulties, please contact your local mental health center.
Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out.
Breathe in.
Breathe out.
This is Psychoanalysis.
Hi, listeners. This is Jen. This is actually part two of our episode on Mulholland Drive and dreams. So if you have not already, check out part one of this episode. It should already be in your feed. It dropped on Thursday. And in that, Mike gives us a lot of information about dreams and kind of ways that your brain processes things. It's really fascinating. We'll also talk about our first, our feelings check with this movie. And for me and Mike, it was a first watch. So we had a lot of feelings about this the first time we watched it, and our synopsis of the film, and our interview with patron Andrew, who chose this film. So if you have not already listened to that, stop right here, go back and listen to part one, and then come right back, and I will see you soon. Well, so let's dig into the movie. And my first question was, what is real and what is a dream?
Isn't that the question for all of life?
That is the question. Yeah. And nothing is, but what is not, which is, that was supposed to be my senior quote. And I think it's from some Shakespeare thing.
Maybe seems about Hamlet. Right.
Yeah.
Could feel like a Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, as Mike alluded to earlier, I do think that the majority of the film is Diane's dream from the moment at the top of the movie when we see a POV shot of someone falling into red sheets to the moment when the cowboy wakes Diane up and she's in that same bed with the same sheets. You know, obviously that's open to other interpretation. I just wanted to read this little quote from Naomi Watts on Lynch in general. She was being interviewed alongside Lynch, and she said Lynch's whole theory is, we don't all have to have the same understanding. Different things appeal to different people at different times, and it's not all logical and making perfect sense, but if it's real and true, it links up and you can connect. So
I like that.
That was her way of acting through his scripts and connecting with the material in the way that she does to get that performance out of her. So that's just to say, I think you can really interpret any part of this any way you want, and Lynch would honestly like love it. You know, he'd be like, hell yeah. Not that the authorial, you know,
did y'all just hear a scream?
Yeah.
It was a child somewhere in my house.
Yeah, yeah. Not one of yours, just a child.
I love that the instinct, I'm not gonna go check, like, yeah, they're fine.
Yeah, Corey's here.
No, he's got
that
it.
That sounded
it was like play scream.
I'm
that
the same
didn't
way.
Sound deep, like deep fear.
No.
But I'm gonna leave that in because especially for this.
Yeah. Just random screams.
Right.
Anyway. That's all. I just wanted to get that out at the top. But I do think that the idea of this being a dream for the vast majority of the film is supported by a lot of things. Feel free to jump in here because I wrote a lot of notes. She dreams. Diane slash Betty dreams of being the starlet that catches the eye of the director. Betty is everything Diane wants to be. You know, she's innocent. She's fresh. She's immediately recognized for her talent. She rescues Rita instead of killing Camilla. There's a lot of things that just support that this could be her dream, processing the events of Diane's life through this other world. I could keep going down this list, but I don't want to dominate.
It feels like it's guilt. It's the big thing that I took from the last act of the movie is like the dream that she has. It dominates like the first like three quarters of it are her ways to kind of reimagine or reinterpret the guilt that she feels, as well as the regret that she has that her life didn't turn out the way she wanted. And I think it was really when she is talking about the way her career stalled in acting, she's like, well, I read for a director and he didn't really think too much of me. And you kind of,
and
like
Coco is patting her hand.
And you play that back against like the scene where she performs and she does her screen test. What's amazing of what that's probably the moment of the movie that like really kind of dialed me into it. I think that's when I paused it and ordered the Blu-ray.
Hell yeah. That scene is amazing. It's like one of the most weird, unsettling, absorptive scenes ever filmed.
What I really appreciated about that scene is you had gotten evidence on how she was going to read the scene prior to, and then the actor she's playing against makes the comment like, doesn't really matter what I do, they're all going to read the scene the same way anyway. And then Betty's character is immediately able to stop on a dime and play it a completely different way, speaking to the amount of talent she has as a performer. And a lot of times, like, our dreams are either our best selves or they are going. I know that I've gone back and I've had dreams about relationship failures or personal failures that all of a sudden play out in a much different way with a much better outcome. And I think everyone listening to this can point to a moment they've had a dream and they've said, oh man, I don't want to wake up from it. It's so pleasant. I really like being here right now.
Well, I was thinking as I was watching this, I was like, this is probably not what Hollywood is actually like. Like, this seems like a very idealized version of like, oh, you just get off the plane and you have a place to stay and you have all these connections and like you're fresh off the, I mean, you're fresh from wherever, Ontario, and you're meeting these
deep water Ontario or deep river. I can't remember.
Right. Yeah. And then so to have that kind of come back and make sense, like, oh no, this is her idealized version, like, and even to kind of give herself that out of like, oh, the director really wanted to hire me, but it was these mobsters that said he has to hire somebody else, you know. It's like this way of rationalizing this thing that she didn't get, you know.
The just as an aside on that audition scene, yes, obviously, like, so much of this is a bizarre, idealized, like, almost feels predestined march to fame for this Betty character. But also, I feel like there are elements in that sequence that are very much like how Lynch experienced Hollywood. Like, the funniest part of that scene to me is the director that is, like, completely checked out. Like, that guy is just so funny. He's just like, what? Play the scene with heart, but not with mind, you know. And then there's this like creepy actor who like pulls her into this sort of thing that where she's forced to perform closely to him, but she like flips the power dynamic on him by like completely dominating the scene. And there's these casting directors, everything feels, I guess, really sleazy and weird, and like you're being manipulated. And I think that the essence of that is true to the Hollywood experience in a way that is separate from Betty, like, floating like a princess through these events, you know.
And that's more what I mean, the doesn't feel right.
No. And it's the juxtaposition of those elements that I think that make it feel so compelling. You're like, this isn't right, yet on some level it is. I don't know. It's the phrase I wrote in my notes is reverse Wizard of Oz from hell. And I was not surprised. I started Googling some articles and interviews, and people have made the Wizard of Oz connection before, because it's like Dorothy in her normal life goes to sleep and is the hero of this other world. But then she comes back to her life and realizes that her real life was really the better one all along, you know, whereas this is like a very sad, broken woman gets exploited, you know, and strung out by the Hollywood system until she cracks, you know, and does something unforgivable and then runs away to her dreams, but it can never really escape the darkness inside, you know.
Yeah. Well, and if I were to dig into that a little bit, I think it's interesting that even her dream scenario is based on this, like, this system of exploitation, you know, like, even the best case, if she was floating through like a princess, it still involves this like exploitative, like getting pulled in. Like, I did not like that actor. I think you're supposed to not like him. You know, he is very sleazy, I think is the perfect word. But just like the hand, like, even her best case scenario, like the shining dream of this involves her getting exploited, because that's the foundation. And it's like, I think her dream exists within this paradigm of Hollywood that there is no alternate version of it really that she can see. So any dream she's going to have is going to exist within this system. You know,
she's not going to see another version of it because she was never exposed to another version of it. Like, mm-hmm. probably all she ever saw was like a checked out when she had like casting calls. She saw like a casting, you know, a director that was completely checked out. She saw like, you know, actors that would exploit her. And be like, oh, but it's the, you know, latest pretty young blonde woman who's hot off the bus. And I think it's implied in like reality, like she was a marginally talented at best performer. Mm-hmm. So someone they wouldn't have taken seriously at all. And, you know, I know, like, just kind of reading about the movie, like Naomi Watts talked about how she was ready to give up until she got the day of like the audition, like she got lost, was late for the audition, and was ready to basically, in certain points, just like get back on a bus and go back to a normal life. And I think she said Nicole Kidman is a close friend of hers who convinced her to stay, which is interesting.
Well, I mean, interesting given like, and I'm not saying that this is autobiographical for their friendship or anything, but just that she kind of feels like the also ran next to this like glamorous star actress, you know, because Nicole Kidman hit a lot earlier than she did.
Yeah, and I think Naomi Watts really related to this character. I mean, even in some of the interviews, she was talking about that, like she the difference in the experience she had when she met David Lynch versus every other person. She was like, he has a conversation with you. A thing he does is he never makes his actors read the scenes. He just sits down and has a conversation with them and decides based on the conversation whether or not he thinks they're going to be a good fit for the role. He never makes them like audition, which I think is fascinating. But, you know, so she just felt like the way she put it in the interview is like, I felt, how did she say it? She was like, I had lost touch with myself because I was just trying to always guess what people wanted out of me. Did they want me to be pretty? Did they want me to be sexy? And David Lynch was the first person that was just like, I just want you to be, to bring yourself, your authentic self to this role. And it helped her connect with herself again in a, at a time when she felt really disconnected from herself. You know, and I think that the nature of Hollywood being ersatz, being like this, this veneer, everything is a backlot, you know, any building could be a movie set. And that plays out in the Silencio scene where like, it's just a recording. All of this is fake, you know, and like if you just lift back the back, you know, the veil, you'll see what's really, really beneath. I think that those themes really make sense as a way to be explored through dreams and through dreaming.
Yeah.
I think Lynch also explores in that scene or the continuation of the audition scene, like the way Hollywood can be so backbiting. You know, she's immediately pulled out of that room and with the casting agent and the assistant, and they immediately start like trashing the director and saying how like what a washed up has been with no vision that he is. But it's,
and I
all
was married
much,
to him.
Yeah, that was it. Like, I better, you know, I, oh, of course I love him. I should. I was married to him for 10 years. But now you have to meet like this hot new director.
Yeah.
Who himself is being like manipulated and exploited and threatened. I also think another, just another thing that could potentially support, because I mean, if you follow the theory that this whole section of the film is her dream, then everything we see happen to Adam is part of her dream, including being threatened, being, you know, cheated on, all this.
And what is that but wish fulfillment?
Exactly, because in real life, Adam has all the power, took her girl, and is like literally like mocking her to her face, you know?
Yeah. And it's interesting. I find like there's such a big shift that happens in her character when she becomes kind of Diane, I guess, is her, her actual name, you know, and even the name Betty. Like, I had a student named Betty, but it's such a old Hollywood name. It's like a name that doesn't feel quite real. You know, it feels like very glamorous. And there's, I can really connect with that feeling of like, this is what they want me to be. So this is what I'm going to be, you know, like put together, and her clothes are so like stylish, and she and Rita seem to go together so well, you know. And gosh, even Rita's name, like that is an old Hollywood name, you know,
Rita,
from a movie poster.
Yeah.
But the Diane feels just so like a real person.
Yes. It's like you really know, because, well, also I thought it was, I would love to just see a little, you know, series of vignettes set in that apartment complex as if that was the real place, you know, because I love Coco as the landlady of this series of glamorous apartments. And she was, just as an aside, the actress that plays Coco is named Ann Miller, and she was like a 1940s movie star. Like, she, you know, she performed in a bunch of different, like, maybe not star in the way that like Rita Hayworth was, but she was, you know, a well-known actress. And so pulling the, you know, her, she was just perfect for that role. It's like there's something mm-hmm. about her that feels so otherworldly and glamorous and petite and kind of off. You know, and like, so, but then seeing her recontextualized as the director's mother also makes sense, but in a much uh-huh. less like glamorous and fun way. It's just, he's like a legacy Hollywood kid, like so many people are in that system, mm-hmm. you know, like they don't, no one arrives off the bus with no connections and makes it, or very rarely. It's always people right. who are already entrenched and connected.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things I was thinking as I was watching this is like this, and I'm sure he's not the first person to say this, but in On Writing, Stephen King writes, everybody is the main character in their own story, you know? Mm-hmm. And so as you look at this dream, like Anne is the main character, not Anne, Betty is the main character mm-hmm. in this dream, and then it shifts and the focus is all on Camilla, and you mm-hmm. can see her like this wish fulfillment, like I am the star, this is like what happens to me is important and other people care about it and I'm the main character, whereas I think in reality she feels just forgotten and just kind of tossed aside, you know,
totally.
Or like dead in her apartment for 3 days and nobody even notices, you know.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, Betty is the hero. I mean, well, Diane is the hero in Betty's dream. Mm-hmm. Like in Betty's, it's an inverse of the relationship that Diana and Camilla had with one another mm-hmm. in that, in like the actual relationship, like Camilla held all the power. Mm-hmm. And I think like you kind of, it's hinted at, or you can see that like Camilla viewed what she had with Betty as very much maybe a fling.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. As something, you know, and there's just like the unconscionable cruelty of like once she has broken it off with mm-hmm. Diana, of inviting her to this big
right.
event where they're going to announce her engagement. It just feels like so casually cruel, because you see not the looks that Camilla is shooting over to Diana at the night, and the look in her eyes is one of like almost the anticipation one would get on Christmas morning mm-hmm. when you're waiting to open like that, you know, like you've been waiting all year to get that Xbox and now you're going to finally open that box. Like Camilla is waiting with this real sense of glee of like how this is going to drive a dagger through the heart of her.
It's fucked up. It's really mm-hmm. bad, because it's like, you know, the fact that, you know, in the dream she is gets into the accident at the same place where she takes Diane up the steps, the hidden path to mm-hmm. the house. It's like this is such a place of becomes such a place of power in her imagination mm-hmm. because of it is kind of a small trauma that happens to her. I mean, it's not even small. It's very humiliating and heartbreaking, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's the scene where everything shifts in her dream, is like now that's where Rita gets hurt and Betty essentially rescues her, you know, versus actually ordering a hit on her.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, if I were to make the connection to like body horror, you know, I think we've talked about that as a way of showing emotional trauma on the body. Mm-hmm. And so like it's really hard to probably for Diane to unpack or to explain how much this hurt her, this moment where she was pulled out of the car. But seeing someone turn around and point a gun at you and then you get smashed into by cars, like you can understand how much that hurt, you know. So it's like this adding a level of easily digestible pain to try to process this really complex emotional pain where you lose power, but it's just such a subtle shift, but it feels like everything is shifting internally. But we wouldn't know, like if you didn't know her, you wouldn't see any difference. But you see a difference when a car smashes into you head on, you know?
And it kind of like wipes her memory. She gets like a head trauma. I think that is really interesting. I like that read of it, like that this obvious wound on her head is like, it discombobulated Diane's sense of self as much as like a head trauma. Like her whole sense of reality just got thrown into disarray by that.
Yeah. Well, and even the moment where she was like, because they don't ever say we're going to get married, right? Like they don't say the word. It like stretches out and then
yeah,
it's
they're like
the
giggling
crash.
And it's but it's like it's very obvious that like that's what's going on, and you know.
But I find it so interesting because it's like she can't even say that word in her dream. You know, it's like it stretches out. It's like she doesn't even want to quite go that far. You know, her brain won't let her. You know.
Although I think by that point it's no longer. I mean, I interpreted that part as not dream, as like happened. As like the real thing, but it's also like it's a very Lynchy way of like writing that scene also. So I don't know how to interpret that, like the fact that they don't say that. I mean, it adds to the uncertainty of everything. Like maybe Diane was really just a crazy bitch and she imagined this and it created a paranoid fantasy and killed this woman. You know, there's a way to read it that way too. But I think that to me, it's like pretty clear, like this is a very intentionally, even if they weren't announcing they were going to get engaged, like they were just like, we're doing another picture together. And also we're clearly fucking, you know, like,
right. You know, we're like, not together anymore. We are.
Right. Yeah. It was very much like a power move on a woman who has no power at all. Mm-hmm. And so the only thing she can think to do is then to resort to violence, you know.
Look at the inverse of that in the dream relationship where it's like Betty that has all the power, like Betty has the place to stay. Like she has a sprawling apartment where she's able to stay, like who knows how long her aunt Irene is going to be gone for. So she's able to open up the apartment to the stranger who is like clearly suffering and clearly lost and clearly scared. Like Betty is the one to make the suggestions of like, oh, we need to call this person. Oh, we need to go there. Oh, let's break in to the apartment and see what, like she is the, you know, we said like, the hero of her own story. Mm-hmm. And she's acting in a way that is much more kind and empathetic towards Rita, who is someone who is clearly in need of help at that moment. Mm-hmm. So she is in her dream self acting as the idealized version of what she hoped she would have received when she was in need of that kindness and that warmth and that structure. Mm-hmm. She's expressing all those characters in her, in all those characteristics in her dreamlike stage, which makes the last third of the movie or quarter of the movie that much sadder. Yeah. Like it's really fucking tragic.
It's really awful to see, because as silly as like the whole Betty character and everything is, you do kind of like fall in love with those characters, you know, a little bit. You're like invested in their life and what they are portraying, and then so seeing like the real Diane is really sad. I mean, they gave her like these fake teeth or something to make her teeth look kind of fucked up, and she's still so clearly like Naomi Watts, but just a completely different person. And she looks like she's been fucking through it and is very, very on the verge, as it turns out to be true. You know, it is really gut wrenching.
Naomi Watts is so good in this movie that like when she first wakes up from that dream and you just see her facial tics and her body language, like immediately I'm like, this isn't the same character.
Totally.
Like, you know, like that is not like, this is not Betty anymore. And it's like before anything is even said.
Yeah. It's a stunning, it's really, I've like got to be up there as far as performances go, like just a masterclass in like performance.
Well, we mentioned him a little earlier. Do we want to talk about Adam maybe?
Sure.
I love Justin Theroux. I thought he was fantastic. Like, he just seems like this kind of like kind of douchebaggy kind of person that I just love to.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. But he just, I feel like he understands that he is kind of that character in this, you know, and I've seen him in some other stuff and, you know, I'm like, I wonder if that's just kind of a little bit of him, but maybe he's just a nicer version, but I don't know. I thought he was fantastic in this role. And I think it was just so funny, like to see him just kind of wandering around with pink splattered on him, you know, and to think about just pouring the pink paint on her jewelry. I thought that was hilarious.
He and gets cucked so hard. I've never seen someone get cucked as hard as he gets cucked.
Why, Billy Ray Cyrus. I mean, I know I already said it, but it's just such a bizarre thing. And it reminds me of like the Rita Hayworth thing. It's like if you are dreaming and you just happen to have seen, like maybe my kids had Encanto on. And so that kind of just pops its way into a dream, you know?
Totally.
It's just like your mind is processing through all of that stuff. And just like if you happen to see a Rita Hayworth poster, it's very like, I don't know. I don't want to say the usual suspects, but it's like these things just all kind of digest their way through your story.
Yeah.
You know,
which I do feel is like at least very true of my experience with dreams. It's like, why did that show up? Why was I looking at McDonald's wrappers in a trash can? It was like, then you remember you saw that at work, you know, and you're like, what? Why was that the thing that got lodged in my dream?
Well, it's funny. When I was the first time we see the waitress and her name tag says Diane, I was like debating with myself if I should write that down in the synopsis. I was like, does this mean anything? Or is this, because I'm always just kind of want to write every single thing down, as Laura can attest to. She sees my rough drafts. And it's so funny. It's like those things are meaningful. You just don't understand why. But sometimes they're not. And sometimes it's not worth, right? But your brain's filtering through it, you know?
And this is a side, no, I do want to talk more about Adam, but there's these several characters that are like doppelgangers of Betty. Mm-hmm. And I've never totally known what to do with it. Like the waitress, the other actress that is like the one that he's that Adam is supposed to pick for the with role.
Melissa George.
Yeah. And... like there's a lot of these sort of blonde women wandering around, kind of like that could be interchanged with each other. And you kind of have to squint. You're like, wait, is that, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't totally know what to do with that, other than that it's maybe like the truth of Diane being so aware of how replaceable she really is, and that she's just like a cog in a machine and there's 1,000 people just like her. I don't know if that totally re-scans, but to me it feels right. I also just want to comment on that waitress's haircut. That was such an early 2000s haircut, and I forgot that it existed. The like long in the front, spiky in the back, like
It's very like was 10 things I Rachel? Hate about you.
No, that was the not Rachel, Rachel is was earlier in the
like
90s.
Longer okay. layers.
It's more of like a long bob, like a layered bob, you know. But
it's that, like that... Anne Heche, I think, had that haircut for a while.
Yes, and like Don and Kate plus 8.
Oh, yep, and one of my old principals.
Yeah, it's a. Yeah. I think it then became the I voted for Trump haircut as we proceeded into
the Karen.
But anyway, it occupied a lot of my attention for some reason. That getting back to Adam, I also just love, even though it's like it ends up not real, his narrative ends up being like you could have easily just shown him getting like hit by a car or something, and then he would be like, that's what she wished could happen to him. We get this drawn out side B plot with him, and I love it because it is so entertaining.
The cowboy scene is so much fun.
It's, and Justin Theroux is so good in that, because this is another one where David Lynch didn't tell him as a performer like what was going on. He was asking him like, what is supposed to be happening? Am I in a dream? Is this real life? Like, and David Lynch was like, I don't know, buddy, but we'll figure it out together. And that befuddlement he plays so well is just like, this fucking cowboy is coming at me right now. What the fuck is this? And like, but he's just kind of like, I love it.
And just the dialogue of like, if you do this right, I will see you 2 more times. Or I can't even remember what it was, but just that like intriguingness. But
yes,
like, so suddenly, not quite deadpan, but almost like cowboy deadpan.
Yeah, it's like suddenly you've entered a James Ellroy novel, and you don't know why, and you're not a James Ellroy character, but everyone's talking to you like you are. Like Cookie he's at the shady hotel, and Cookie is like the men that are after you, and then that guy with the mustache shows up at Silencio, and you're just like, there's all these like, I don't know, they just, again, like you said, archetypes, they feel like, but then there's certain characters that are still feel really grounded. Mm-hmm. And that combination is so fun to watch. Like I will just sit back and watch that scene over and over again, because it delights me so much. I love the cowboy.
When you think about your enemies, when you think about the people you despise the most in your life, do you want a quick and painless death for them, or do you want them to suffer?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I can't say on the record. I'm not going to answer that question on this recording. You know,
yeah,
I mean, look, sometimes we just want bad things to happen to bad people.
What? Yeah, and no, absolutely.
It would be, it's much more fun to watch, you know, even in the dream state, to watch like Adam kind of like lose his wife, get cucked, lose his home. The next thing, like he goes into hiding and all his money is taken from him. All the power that he has on the picture is taken from him. So his life is a continuing set of misfortunes, kind of like the character in like Kafka's The Trial.
Totally.
Where, you know, and that's what like Adam's story actually reminded me of this character who is like increasingly getting caught in this bureaucratic system that is unwieldy and out of his control, and bad things will happen to him. More fun to watch. Right. That is a lot more fun to kind of watch play out.
What's so fascinating is, as I was watching him like walking out with, I couldn't tell what it was. Was it a walking cane? And then it turns out to be a golf club. And then he just smashes the shit out of this car. And that never comes back to mean anything. And I remember thinking, why does he have a golf club in his hand? But that's such a dream thing to do. It's just suddenly you happen to have the thing you need to do the thing that you want. And it's just such this like really cool dream logic that you don't understand until you see the whole thing as a whole, you know?
There's a lot of elements that I don't, did I say this already, where like we don't really ever return to them. They just kind of happen. Uh-huh. And they're a hell of a lot of fun to watch, but that's also like a very dream thing. Like sometimes there's just elements that happen and you're like, okay, like, I don't know. The two cops at the beginning crack me up because they're given so much gravitas and you think that they're going to come back and they're like, they just like, I found the earring. Weird. And then return to them. And the hitman sequence, the bumbling hitman.
Like, oh yeah. Which was hilarious.
So good. I just, that by itself is a fun little short, you know.
I want to talk about Joe, because obviously like Joe the hitman is the character that does in
Camilla.
And that's why you go back to the blue key and you get the meaning, okay, what does the blue key actually mean? And that makes it all the more like gut-wrenching when you just see it sitting there on the table. But he's very much like this character that like kind of pops in and out of the movie. I kind of read that, like going back and looking at it, is like, even in a dream, when you're seeing your ideal self, like Joe represents this thing is like, you know, at some point you have to wake up from it and you keep coming. Like he's coming at them. Like you see him make that bumbling hit when he shoots the woman in the ass through the,
some of the funniest scenes.
Things just so keep good.
Escalating and going wrong. Like this little hall, like shitty office corridor. Like it's perfect.
Yeah.
But even though everything is going wrong, he's still coming.
Yeah.
And then later on, he talks to the woman who's very much like a doppelganger for, for Betty.
That's another one. There's the like, I'm assuming sex worker that he's talking to earlier in the movie. I knew it's there like was looking one other out
for
woman.
Any new girls. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you know that like at some point, like his paths are going to cross with, I mean, that's what you're building towards. It felt like in this dream, like his path somehow are going to cross with Rita and Betty, and you think it's going to be over this money,
right?
You think it's going to be over that.
You think it's setting up the threat of whatever Rita, whoever she really is, was attacked for, because we don't know. We just know that somebody's after her. She had money in her purse. You think it's going to set up this, like, you know, gangland sequence, but and then it's like they're just actually fragments from this other life that are is equally scary and awful, just much less cohesive and satisfying. Yeah.
Well, and I kind of read the sprawling bumblingness and like collective body counts, and now suddenly the building is on fire too, you know, as like maybe like an anxiety of like, what has she actually gotten herself into, you know, and like, I am trusting this person that I really can't trust, you know,
unintended consequences, exactly. Like a domino effect kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
And just kind of a way of processing that through this stupid, really funny story, you know.
And I have a lot of anxiety dreams, so that really resonates with me because it's like with my anxiety dreams, it'll be like one thing is like, oh, guess what? You never actually graduated eighth grade. So you have to, as an adult, go back to eighth grade and finish and go through all of school from there. And then I get there and all the other kids hate me because I'm an adult in class, and it spirals into this insane series of events. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, so that really, I vibe with it.
Yeah, I have a lot of anxiety dreams too. And one of them is the staircase. I went to high school with a lot of staircases, and that they would just crumble under my feet, you know, as I was trying to like get to
a class or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Also, the can't remember my locker combination, can't find a parking spot, can't find my locker.
Yeah, I have all those as well.
Those are basically the only dreams I ever remember, the anxiety ones. So,
Jen, what do you make of the Winkies?
I wanted to talk about early Winkies. In the movie.
We can't leave this without talking about Winkies.
Absolutely. Yes. I had seen that scene before. Like, I'd seen people post this on Twitter many times. Like, this is one of the scariest things I've ever seen. And so then I like actually looked up the scene on YouTube and I watched the scene in its entirety without any context to the movie. And I thought this character was going to be a character in the movie, you know? And so as I was watching this, I was like, is the whole reason we chose this movie to talk about dreams, is it because of this scene? And if it was, I still think there's a lot to say about it. But then seeing it as a whole, I was like, okay, no, there's a lot more to it. But man, that sequence is terrifying and so haunting, you know, now that you see the whole thing, and to see him come back in that moment where he's talking about seeing the face from outside. And I wonder if that is like her knowing that what she is doing is kind of damning her, you know, but she can't get out of it because she's already set it in motion or it's already happened, you know, and it's just this, I don't know, impending damnation is kind of how I read it. It reminds me in ways of the Hellraiser person at the very end of the movie. There's like this kind of lurking figure, you know, but just this idea of the evil intent underneath, or the terror underneath of what, once everything is stripped away, you know?
Yeah. Oh, what the hell? Sorry, hold on. Is it still going? I keep getting this weird error message coming up from GarageBand, and I think it's stopping the recording, but then I think it's still going. Hope it didn't.
It's still going here.
It is.
Yeah.
Still going
here, it just like was like, what the fuck is this? Okay. But yeah, that shout out one to that actor. I was just looking up his name, Patrick Fischler. He's in a ton of stuff, and he shows up in Twin Peaks: The Return. He's always so good when he shows up as these kind of neurotic characters.
He's so intense.
Yeah. Intense and neurotic.
But vulnerable too. You know?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. There's something about him. Those big eyes.
Perfect note. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's something, he says something in that scene that's like, there's this, for starters, it's like, there's the diner where everything is happy, and then, but there's something behind the diner. And I know it's there, even though everything seems normal and we've got these happy plates of breakfast food. There's something behind the diner, and it's making it happen. He says, you know, he's making it happen, I think, about the dumpster person. And then they come back at the toward the end of the movie. And I never really knew what to do with that, that they show the I think, I can't remember exactly how it plays out. It's like it's right before or right after the two little old people come out of the box for Diane. You just see the dumpster person sitting there, and there's like a fire in a can, and they're holding the box. And I never totally knew what to do with that, but I also read it as part of this idea of like, there is a surface portrayal of things, and then there's the ugly truth behind it. And just being represented, and also like the character is coded, you know, I mean, not coded, the character is supposed to be unhoused, homeless, or whatever you want to call it. I think that they're in the credits as the bum, you know? So it's like, that's just like complete devastation. Like, you come, it's like truly like Boulevard of Broken Dreams shit. Like, you come to the big fancy town hoping for your chance, and you end up not only not succeeding, but living behind a dumpster, behind a diner. Like, that is like the ultimate opposite of what Betty came to Hollywood for, you know? So I don't totally know what to do with all these things, but they're all thoughts that occurred to me during the movie.
No. Well, and shout out to Bonnie Ahrens, who is the actress. I had to look her up because she's also the nun in the, like, she's just one of those like incredibly strikingly beautiful, but also terrifying faces.
And very intense looking. And it lends itself to being, her face lends itself to being put in different types of makeup and being really effectively, and just a great, again, great, scary, unsettling performances from her.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about the scene in the Silencio club. Silencio before we go on, because I think it's like, and I think,
sorry, I'll stop.
That's the one that I feel like I do not have a hold on, you know, like I almost forgot about it because it's so, it feels like it exists outside of my mind.
Yeah. Well, it feels like, I mean, Lynch is, you know, when he talks about his movies, you can interpret them any way you want. I in the scene, it puts everything in front of you as an audience member. It tells you, like, look, nothing you see here is real.
Yeah, exactly.
Everything is fake. Everything is a recording. And then it demonstrates it. It demonstrates it time and time again. You have, like, the trumpet player come out playing the trumpet, and then he stops, but the music still goes. You have, like, he tells you that you're going to hear music from here. It's all a recording. None of it is real. It's all fake. And then the nightclub singer
Rebecca
comes out,
Hillary,
and
she
does this like searing version of Roy Orbison's crying in her native language, in Spanish, and it's incredibly moving and beautiful, and you see how it affects Betty and Rita, and they're bawling over it, and then at the end, like, the Rebecca drops and the music continues, and it's so jarring and jolting.
You forgot, you somehow forgot, even though they literally just told you that everything is a recording, that this was going to be a recording. Like,
it shows you how well art can pull you in, how you can suspend your disbelief, how you can allow yourself to get consumed by something so moving, so and so beautiful. But at the end of the day, it's still artifice. So I think it's a really wonderful way of Lynch kind of showing his hand at that moment. Yes. Like, this is what I'm capable of doing. I really love, even though that scene in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't really affect. I guess the only thing I could say is, like, it's Betty waking up to the idea
exactly
that like this is all going to end soon, like this isn't real. Very soon, like reality is going to come crashing down.
It's a liminal space to me. It's between, mm-hmm. it's the moment when you start to wake from a dream and you're going, no, mm-hmm. no, I don't want to wake up. It's yeah. Because the way that they're reacting to it too, it's like the sequence of events is like they make love and it's beautiful. It's really like, it's like a very like sexy scene, but it's actually like, what struck me about it is there's a lot of like emotion in it. Like they really seem mm-hmm. like they like love each other, you know? And mm-hmm. it's very hard to do that and not make it like cringy, like to watch, yeah. you know? But then they wake up and are like, got to go to Club Silencio. It's 2 a.m. Okay, I'll go anywhere for you and with you. And it's like, as they start to see these things, it is like a growing sense of dread. And they're kind of clutching each other and going mm-hmm. like, oh, shit, I forgot mm-hmm. something. Yep. Oh, shit. Oh, shit. Oh, shit. And then when they finally see it, it's like, no, 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 no. And then it's followed shortly thereafter by Diane waking up. Mm-hmm. And Cowboy says, come on, girl, it's time to wake up, you know? Mm-hmm. And like, I don't know, it really upset. It's like, it's very emotional to me. It's very like, mm-hmm. that is that feeling mm-hmm. put on film, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, just the thought of one of the images that was really striking to me is when you just fall into the box, you know, and it's like nothing. Mm-hmm. You know? It's mm-hmm. like, oh. I don't even really have anything to say about it, but it just was very affecting.
Yeah, it is. It's like, that's the thing. It's like some, he finds this imagery that is inexplicable mm-hmm. that somehow conveys exactly the right feeling, you know? And it's like, right. if you really look at it, you're like, well, why is it a box? Why is it a key? You know?
Right.
But it's yeah. like, that doesn't matter. It's like, he is showing you the movement through dream into waking and how you feel like you're sucked out of one very real world into another that's somehow a different kind of real, mm-hmm. you know? I don't know. That's why I love him so much as a filmmaker. He finds these really original images and things that just convey such profound emotion that is, mm-hmm. and it's the kind of emotions that are really hard to put into words and verbalize yep. without being like cheesy and lame, you know? Yeah. And he finds ways to make you go on those experiences with him. Yeah. I fucking love it so much.
Like, I just think too, Lynch knows like the box. Like, the box is a symbol of like it, for the audience wanting to know what's going on. Just works. I mean, mm-hmm. think about the briefcase in Pulp Fiction. Yes. And like it's 30 years later, and we're still asking like, what the fuck is in the briefcase?
Mm-hmm. What's in the box? Think about, like, what's in the box? Yeah,
exactly. J.J. Abrams calls like his things mystery boxes. Mm-hmm. You know, like when you see that, you immediately like as soon as it's like Chekhov's gun. As soon as someone introduces like a locked box onto a screen, you immediately want to know like what's in it. When are you going to reveal it? Show me. Show you. You never quite forget about mm-hmm. it the second that it's introduced.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and then like the fact that it there's nothing in it, and that you get mm-hmm. the characters get sucked into it, and then it does open a new world, and you see the truth. Mm-hmm. So you really should have never looked in the box.
But that need to know is such like a human emotion, and I've been thinking. Mm-hmm. I just wrote a thing about Texas Chainsaw Massacre and just like the randomness of tragedy, you know, and just like that sometimes you just have to let go of the fact that you're going to ever have an answer that makes sense, you know. Yeah. But mm-hmm. the need to keep knowing what's inside the box, even if you know it's not going to be anything, still exists, which is why like we know that we're never going to find out what's in the briefcase, but we still want to know, and we still like every time you're like, maybe if I look at it in just the right way, you know. Yeah, I love the idea of putting the like pure emotion on screen, and that's like half of what my therapy has been, is trying to figure out what these emotions are and what they mean to me and what they connect to, and kind of that's what brain spotting is just like seeing a thing and just going with it and digging down into the deepness of it and figuring out what it connects to and what it pulls up. And sometimes it pulls up random stuff and you just let it go, and then sometimes it like catches onto a trail and you keep going and it's like, oh shit, well that was the root of it, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and I think it's fascinating, and it takes a lot of talent and confidence to really try to put that on screen for someone else to experience it through your lens, but still feel like it's through their lens.
And just as a side note to that, I think a lot of this was, again, Lynch processing his own sense of loss and mm-hmm. sort of broken ideals over having worked in Hollywood for so long, all the stuff he went through with Twin Peaks. I think if you watch Fire Walk With Me, that is a lot of directly about his experience working with television, you know, and mm-hmm. and them not like understanding or trusting his vision, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, and obviously this is about like the Hollywood baby, you know, and it's him kind of like processing a lot of that, and then moving on from it. Inland Empire is another one of his movies that's really about like Hollywood system. So if you have Fire Walk With Me, Inland Empire, and Mulholland Drive, it's a lot of that. A lot of that to me is him processing his own experiences as an artist. I know that's how, when I say these things, it sounds a little shallow somehow. Like, but I think that he is using his experience to express bigger things than just himself. You know, it's like he's doing two things at once. Like he's processing his own life through this sort of surreal style that he has, but it also allows other people to attach their own experiences to it. Cause otherwise, like, you could see if like a well-known director made a very bitter movie about not Hollywood not liking him, that would be like the lamest shit of all time. You'd be like, you entitled little son of a bitch. But like that, you know, I could see that going so wrong, you know, and being so unrelatable. But yet he takes these experiences he's had and he's made something that is so universally relatable if you are open to it, you know, and can just go, because it's like this, again, collective unconscious, shared emotions, shared experiences. And I find that like, I don't really think there's any other filmmaker that has nailed it like he has, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it feels to me like art that is intended to please or to fill a certain niche, and then art that exists for art's sake, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like we talk about when you write a well-rounded character, you allow your audience to connect to them in ways that maybe you didn't anticipate, you know? And that's kind of what I see with this movie is like, he is, by trying to explore his own like processes in an authentic way, he leaves enough room for other people to do it. And if he were just saying, I want to write a movie about this being Hollywood, that limits everybody, you know?
Exactly.
And it's like, this is my experience. You either buy it or you don't. Whereas like his, like, I feel like honest desire to do that. And I'm saying this, I'm not familiar with him at all, but that's what opens the door, you know?
I mean, it's at least what he says over and over again in interviews, that he wants people to interpret his movies any which way. He doesn't like to give concrete answers. He's very enigmatic about it. And people are like, the box, people are always picking at him. What does it mean? What does it mean? And he's like, that is not the point. Like, you know, I'm trying to express something. And if you go along with me for the ride, then it's served its purpose. Like, and I just, that's the vibe. That's like, that is like how I feel about life and art and the real power of art. And I just get really geeky about it because I just love it so much. Like, I just, I'm like, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, it's like, it's the question, not the answer.
Yeah. And it's like, that is, there's something like, if I become at all spiritual, this is how I get spiritual. It's these kind of universal truths and the ways that we're all connected to each other despite vastly different life experiences, and like that we're all kind of part of the same clay, just like dreams and all these images are all kind of part of the same collective unconscious. I just love it.
There are like readings of this movie that don't that dispute whether it's a dream or not.
Sure.
And they touch more on the idea of like string theory and the fact that like there are thousands, if not more, like parallel universes that we bump up against. And somehow like these two of these universes have somehow intersected with one another. Like upon rebound, the strings became entwined with one another. And that's why you see this like idealized version in the front three quarters of the film, and you see how that become entangled with the back half of the film, which plays out in a much more horrific and tragic way. And I kind of like that idea as well, this idea that there are many versions of ourselves running about, each of us, and all of us contain some version of them inside of us, but they play out differently in parallel worlds. I do like that.
I like that too.
Yeah. Well, and that kind of goes back to the thing I was saying about the archetypes and Jung, and like this idea of like who we are as a concrete thing, and does it exist in multiple variations, and as your dreams are exploring that. Because I think we're like, what I understand myself to be is a multitude of all of these different things working together, you know? So
I think there's the one thing to me that really supports that potentially. it's all very nebulous, but is the Aunt Ruth thing, like how when they Betty and Rita disappear and the box is on the floor, but then we see Aunt Ruth walking around the apartment going, it's almost like she just heard something. And but we don't see any evidence of them having been there. So you're like, huh? But at the same, there's in the Diane says something, I think, at the party where she's being humiliated, that like she got some money from her aunt.
Yep.
Who died.
She stayed with her aunt. Yeah, I saw that as like she stayed with her aunt for a bit. Her aunt left all her money to her in her will. And that's where she was able to get the money to kill
right,
have Camilla killed.
Right. Yeah. So then, well, what does that say? If Ruth is dead, then who was that Ruth we saw walking around? Who is mm-hmm. the Ruth we saw at the beginning? But the Ruth we see walking around exists with no one there to observe her. And so mm-hmm. it's not necessarily part of Diane's dream or Betty dreams. And it's almost like in some other universe, there's just Ruth is still alive yeah. and just heard the ghost of something on another dimension. Because there's also a lot of theories that like ghosts are these kind of like interdimensional echoes mm-hmm. of and are all part of this universal phenomenon, you know? So it's
and just like Coco in the dream world is like the landlord who kind of like watches over the whole complex and is really kind to in the dreams, like she's very kind to Betty. In what we consider like the reality, you know, Coco is like the director's mom and she's kind but patronizing yes. to Diane. And she's like, oh, finally you're here. Now we can eat, mm-hmm. you know, kind of like the fret's the first thing she says to her. And she kind of is patronizing in a way because she has probably seen hundreds, if not more, Bettys, like these yes. Young and young women who come to the city to make it big. Like, oh, you won a jitterbug contest, and now you're going to be the next Marilyn Monroe.
Mm-hmm. It's also such like a weird old fashioned thing that feels made up. Mm-hmm. You know, like jitterbug contest. Okay,
so maybe like the Rita that we see when the box falls to the floor isn't the same Rita that we see leaving the apartment in the beginning, like going on that trip. She could just be the man of like another woman that like at some point Betty has run into mm-hmm. that is like stuck with her in some conscious way. Mm-hmm. So
yep.
Yeah, I'm forever going to think of those people as Rita Hayworths, you know, just like this random person that just happens to stick in your brain.
Yeah, the Rita Hayworth effect.
Yeah. Patent pending, I guess. Well,
I mean, Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah, again, it's then you can go into a whole King's mm-hmm. King's Dominion. King's
Dominion.
Thing.
There are go. Other worlds than these. You
You're
know?
Right, right.
Well, is there anything else we want to mention before we move on? I feel like we kind of have hit it.
I think we're good.
Yeah. Well, let's mention briefly any other mental health topics that we see in this movie. Not going to dig into them. We just like to mention things when we see them occur. And we do. The only thing I really saw was we do see a suicide in this. And I think that's something that we're going to cover at some point. But it just is present.
I have one quick question. Mm-hmm. Do we think Adam is dead? And is that what the pink splatter on his jacket is, where he's walking around covered in pink paint?
I hadn't thought about him being dead.
I hadn't thought about that either.
How would he have died? Enough. From the mobsters, maybe?
Yeah. Gunshots.
Okay. I mean, maybe he
maybe the pink splatter.
Maybe when the hitman kills Camilla, he's there. They're in bed together. Yeah. Like he walks in and catches her and Billy mm-hmm. Ray Cyrus. Yeah. Huh. Interesting. I hadn't thought about that. I dug that color a lot. That's yeah. You know, as you can see by the outline, it's one of my favorite colors.
It's just a good cinematic image, the all black, like stupid little Mandarin collar outfit that he's wearing and it's covered in pink paint. It sort of just visually represents his downfall. Mm-hmm. The only other thing I wanted to mention is like, I don't know if you really call this a mental health topic, but like abusive workplaces or abusive work environments, like mm-hmm. because whatever Diane ends up doing, that is obviously wrong. You can't just go kill people, but
right,
she is being like abused and manipulated and gaslit by like mm-hmm. you know, Camilla is like, I love you, but then I'm gonna make out with the director in front of you, and I'm gonna invite you to this party where I humiliate you in front of everyone. Like it's very like people are toying with her in weird ways, and I think that affects her deeply.
Yeah, well, and I think we're seeing the cumulative effects of that through this movie and this dream. Yeah. Well, before we mention any other films we see dreams in, let's talk about the second film we've chosen for this topic. I'm very excited and also very scared. We're going to be talking about more nightmares, specifically those that happen on Elm Street. But never fear, we're also going to be talking about Dream Warriors. I know they can help me get through the night. sorry, that was not the right key.
I wasn't singing in the right key. Lord knows.
It's a David Lynch film, so I don't feel like we have to, you know. But this is not a David Lynch film. We're going to be talking about Nightmare on Elm Street 3, The Dream Warriors. I'm very excited, also very nervous to talk about some veins, because that scene fucks me up, maybe more than any other scene in horror. So
it's pretty bad, yeah.
It's, oh, sorry, I just thought about it. Okay. Okay. Carry on. I got to scrub my mental image. Okay, so now let's talk about any other films we see dreams represented in. Not going to dig into them, but yeah, I mentioned Gerald's Game just because I think that is a film where I think she works through a lot of her issues through her dreams and through her interpretation of reality. So I don't know why that popped into my brain, but you know.
Yeah, I didn't. Right, you mentioned Carnival of Souls earlier, which I think is an interesting because there's like a sort of duality to her existence there. Mm-hmm. Or not knowing you're dead is kind of similar to being trapped in a dream.
Yeah, I mean, kind of does exist outside of its own. Like it feels like a genre unto itself. You know, like yeah. As you said earlier. Yeah,
I feel like there's some obvious thing that I'm missing or forgetting, like some dream themed films. But right. Yeah, nothing else is immediately jumping to mind.
Yeah,
at least in. Yeah.
The only thing that jumps out to me in terms of like playing out like this movie does is Donnie Darko.
Yeah, I can see that. It's, yeah. You know,
I haven't seen that in a long time.
I wonder how that one has aged.
Yeah, me too. All right. Well, now it's time for an uplifting moment. This is where we share any grounding and coping techniques or any self-care that's been particularly effective for us. Grounding and self-care are the little tips, tricks, mantras, or practices that help us get through the hard days and hard moments. And self-care is anything we do that makes us feel good or feel better. And I have treated myself to two ear-related self-care things recently.
Ear-related.
Yeah, I talked about a lot. I've talked about my scar phobia, and that kind of translates to earrings. And since the pandemic has begun, I've lived with this fear of my holes closing together and having to like essentially re-pierce my ears. And it just really freaks me out. But I don't want to not have pierced ears because I do occasionally like to wear earrings. So I treated myself to some comfy earrings, which are designed to take naps in, and they're flat back, and I have them in now, and the headphones aren't bothering me. And I did have to, like, it really upset me to put them in because I had left earrings out for too long, and I had to take an anxiety pill.
Actually, I've never had my ears pierced because I have tattoos, and that doesn't bother me at all. But the idea of piercings have always freaked me out. The thing, like, going through something is
right. It does. And then I started thinking, like, what are we doing? We're shoving metal through our skin. And I mean, that's no judgment, but you know.
Yeah, when you start to like think about it, you're like, wait, what am I even doing? Yeah,
exactly.
But there's so many things. Yeah, like
yeah. But tattoos don't bother me either. But so I've really enjoyed them. It hurt that one of them hurt for a couple of days, not because of the earrings, but because of me, and I left them out too long. But the other one was I bought a pair of earplugs. They're called Loop, but they're designed to filter noise. And I kept seeing this ad say triggered by noise, and I am very triggered by noise lots of times. And so they have two different designs that are, one is like to block all noise and the other is to filter noise so that you just can kind of focus on who you're talking to. So I've enjoyed them.
Nice. What are they called again?
Loop. There are probably lots of different variations of them, but that's the one that I got. I like them. So, yep. My ears are happy.
Can't say that I've been doing anything especially good. Like I said, I've been watching Twin Peaks, The Return. I told you guys off air, I've had a weird week. I've had a weird couple of months. I've had a weird life. I don't even know anymore where I am in the span of time in my mental health. But, you know, sometimes watching things can be really helpful. I mean, I know that's the whole premise of this fucking podcast. But, like, watching Twin Peaks The Return, it's been helping me process things that I guess I have been struggling to articulate. Like, I've been writing little poems again. Yeah. I've been writing some... I wouldn't call them short stories, but just like vignette, images that pop into my head. I've been writing them down, which I sort of stopped doing for a long time. And I don't have any big takeaway here, but I've also been like playing guitar a little bit. You know, it's sort of like it's reawakening a creative part of my brain. And the fact that that's happening is good because what scares me most about my depression and stuff is when I just feel nothing and I feel like I've been washed out to the bottoms of the universe where nothing interests me, and it's a really scary feeling to me because it's just like complete emptiness, and this is making me like feel emotions and do things with them. So it's like not like I've been happy, but I've been processing and I've been working through some things, and so I see that as a net positive. And sometimes you forget about the power of like really good media to do that to you. And so just spending a lot of time with with David. That's how he talks. That's me doing my. Been spending a lot of time with David. I don't know. I can't do it. Rothman does the best.
He does, yeah. Yeah. Lynch. Sometimes it sounds like Stephen King, and sometimes those impressions.
Kind of like, yeah, so I feel, yeah. I would like to see the, Stephen King, David Lynch, and Werner Herzog all sit down and have coffee.
I'd like to see Michael Rothman do impressions of all of them having a conversation with each other, too. Just
that would be
subtle
amazing.
Differences. Yeah.
Anyway, I'm going to trail off. that was my statement.
Silencio.
Oh, speaking of like good media, like this has been a weird week. Like I've just been way busier than normal because like my friend had bought us tickets to see a few bands that we used to go see way back in the day. And I had to drag myself out on a Wednesday night to go. And we were just making jokes like, you know, none of this kind of banter in between songs, like tight 25-minute set, no banter in between, like got shit to do in the morning.
Yeah, we are all old now. God damn
we're
it.
All old now. None of this like, you know, setting up your equipment, then walking off stage and coming back 5 minutes later. Like you ain't that big. You're the middle act on a Wednesday night in a 500 person venue. Let's go. Let's move. It was that. And then also it's the week of the Boston Underground Film Fest, which has been, you know, it used to be the week of the year that I looked forward to the most. And in the past few years, as I've moved further and further away from the city and, you know, my taste in movies have changed a little bit. It's like sometimes a drag to kind of get me up to it. But I'm glad I went Friday night and I'll be going again tonight because I've gotten to see people that have like since moved on from the city that I don't get to that I used to spend like a lot of time with that I no longer get to see on a frequent basis, and you realize how much you like miss those friendships and miss that closeness. But also seeing some incredible art, like, and specifically on Friday I saw two genre films, not necessarily horror movies, but like genre movies that deal with mental health in very explicit ways. There's a movie from IFC coming out called Nitrum, which is about the largest mass shooting in Australia's history. Oh. It's done by the director of the Snowtown Murders. Really well done. Like Caleb Landry Jones is pretty amazing in it. And they make a very conscious choice to not show the gun violence. And so it's just, which to me, it actually makes it in some ways more chilling. And then there's a movie coming out called Hypochondriac, which is about a young man's like descent into schizophrenia. And it's very much that movie. Like that's the whole movie is it's about him following in his mother's footsteps.
Sounds bleak.
It actually ends in an uplift. It was getting to that point. It does, like, there's a very good like gay romance at the center of it. And it does show like how those kind of supports can help a person. Like it does end on like a more of an uplifting note. So I'm glad I watched both of them. Like Hypochondriac is extremely well done. I am also ready to take a break from movies that like just do mental illness explicitly. Like I am all for it in terms of like metaphor, but like it is it's kind of hard to watch like a developmentally disabled person slide into becoming like a mass killer and seeing how it's a 2-hour car crash basically. Like you know that it's coming and there's nothing done along the way, but you know, it definitely, you know, it makes me look at the line of work I'm in and get to kind of like reevaluate like how I do things. Is there more that I can do? So I do like when like art like engages me on that level where I'm like, look at the choices I'm making and how to grow from it. So, but yeah, it wasn't necessarily like a fun night out at the movies.
But an important enjoyable. Night out at the movies.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, we want to hear from you. Have you ever been to LA? What do you think the Blue Key opens? And have you ever seen a monster behind a coffee shop? Or what is your grounding and self-care? You can answer all of these questions and more by following us at PsychoApod on all the socials. You can also join our Facebook group, the Psychoanalysis Podcast Support Group. It's a private and moderated group where we can share about episode topics, mental health stuff, and anything else that's on your mind. And you can also email us at psychoapod@gmail.com if you want to share privately. And our homework question for the week, and this is, I'm interested to hear about this. Do you have any recurring dreams? And we're going to briefly share ours real quick. I had this dream where I had to drive. This was before I could drive, but I would have to drive up this gigantic steep highway and it had a huge chunk missing out of it. So I would have to like drive so fast that I could jump it. It was like a combination.
I have a lot of those. Kind of dreams.
And then like later this year, I saw a picture of almost exactly that hill. It's this like gigantic bridge in like Malaysia or something. And I was like, oh my God, it's real. So that very, very
horrifying.
Ominous. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have literal recurring dreams, but I have a lot of like settings and imagery and things that just constantly again and again. I mean, I could go on about this for a long time because I have so many of them. I have very vivid dreams. I remember a lot of them less than I did when I was young, but some of them are it's just like overwhelming, like, you know, and so I have a lot of those. I have car driving anxiety dreams a lot where it's like I'm driving, but I can't control the vehicle or what's happening around me. You're going to notice some themes here. being lost in big, creepy spaces that feel like a combination of shopping malls and museums and that are really cavernous. And I'm lost and I'm wandering around and I'm trying to catch trains. And it's basically a lot of like anxious roaming and being lost. And just, public bathrooms. Those are the other things. Like feeling like going into a public bathroom and every single toilet is like overflowing with shit and blood. And I'm just trying to find a stall and everything is disgusting. And then you finally find a stall and someone is trying to get into it. These are the kind of dreams I have every night. Enjoy. Mike?
I say I have like recurring dreams of my dad still being alive and being just disappointed in me.
I have that with my grandmother.
Yeah. Like literally every single one I ever have with my dad is he is somehow disappointed in me, which, yeah, so probably nothing to read into there.
For any of us. Yeah.
Just, you know right. Nothing there.
Well, we want to hear yours, so look out for that prompt on Saturday. And so what are we watching next? Well, we have another Comfort Horror episode. We are going to be joined by Patrick Hamilton of the Kill by Kill podcast, and we're going to be talking about Happy Birthday to Me, which I have not seen, and I am very excited.
I also haven't seen this.
Ooh.
It's not Happy Death Day. It's Happy Birthday to Me. I don't even know if I've heard of this.
I know. It was very like off the radar, but that was like the first one he picked. So I'm really excited to talk about
that. Oh, a 1981 slasher.
Sweet.
Interesting. Ah. Oh,
it's like a birthday image, treat for all of us.
This image from the cover is a lot.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, I don't know if I'm going to like this. this is a thing that triggers me specifically. Oh, but it's got John Saxton. John Saxton wrote the screenplay?
What?
That John Saxton? Okay, I've got a lot of questions.
All right. So.
It's very good. You'll enjoy it.
Oh, I'm excited. Well, so that's what's up next for us. And for even more of us, Mike, what's going on in the world of Patreon?
Sure. So if you head to patreon.com/psychoanalysis podcast, you will be able to get more bonus content where we put bonus shows up. We put our recommendations up there. We do things like director or fan commentaries, dive into specific characters and look at how we would treat them, like what their issue is and how we would treat them. So yeah, just go to go to patreon.com/psychoanalysis podcast and become a patron today. Andrew, who signed on for this episode, joined at like the one-time donation of $50, where you then get to pick an episode or a movie in the topic that we do, or just do it as a comfort horror. But our tiers start as low as $3 if you want to find a way to support the show.
Awesome. And let's wrap up with some plugs. Laura, where can we find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at underalls, UNDERALLS. That's much like a dream you have where you're suddenly in your underpants and everyone can see them. That's at underalls, UNDERALLS.
Nice.
Occasionally on Losers Club and Halloweenies podcast as well. That's it for me, but baby, that's it. That's it for me, baby.
Yay. And Mike, where can we find you?
So you can find me over on Twitter at Mike_Sununian. You can hear my other show, The Pod and the Pendulum, everywhere you get podcasts. That is where we cover horror movie franchises. And we are finally wrapping up Child's Play. By the time this goes up, we'll have the last two movies in the series to do. Then we're going to do a one-off of Scream 2022's Scream, since that is now out for everyone to see, before we take a road trip down to Texas and do all of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre movies. Jen, that's your cue.
I was going to say, yeehaw! Can we do a yeehaw and a chainsaw? Yeehaw!
Okay. I will say yeehaw when Franklin takes the chainsaw to the gullet.
Oh, so. Franklin, leave Franklin alone.
Leave Franklin alone.
Fuck Franklin.
No, why? He's just a man. He's just a man. You'll have
to tune into the show to find out when we cover that episode.
He's just a little guy.
Oh, he's already spilled pee on himself from the coffee can, too. And you can find me at Jen Ferratu on Twitter and Instagram, and writing and doing other various things and sundries, and yeah, and co-hosting the Losers Club podcast, about to start reading Black House because that's going to be our next book episode, but lots of fun stuff coming up because Firestarter is coming soon and I got a lot to say about that. So, I can't form words very coherently right now, so let's just wrap up. And that's our episode on Mulholland Drive. Thank you so much for joining us for this. This was really fun. A lot of really heavy unpacking, but I think I really enjoyed this episode. A huge shout out to Andrew for choosing this topic and this film. Listeners, thank you so much Listeners, thank you so much for spending time with us. Please make sure to take care of yourselves and take care of each other. And with that, let's sign off. We came here to chew bubblegum and take care of ourselves. And we're
all out of bubblegum.
And we're all out of bubblegum. Okay, I'll stop.
But is there cherry pie?
Ooh, I hope.
No more. Stop.